Germany achieved perfect surprise. All the belligerents had agreed under the Hague Declaration of 1899 concerning asphyxiating gases to abstain from the use of projectiles, the sole object of which is the diffusion of asphyxiating or deleterious gases. None seemed to think tear gas covered by this declaration, though tear gases are more toxic than chlorine in sufficient concentration. The French used tear gas in the form of rifle grenades as early as August 1914. The Germans used it in artillery shells fired against the Russians at Bulimov at the end of January 1915, and on the Western Front first against the British at Nieuport in March. But the chlorine attack at Ypres was the first major and deliberate poison gas attack of the war. As later, with other weapons of unfamiliar effect, the chlorine terrorized and bewildered. Men threw down their rifles and decamped. Medical officers at aid stations were suddenly overwhelmed with casualties, the cause of whose injuries was unknown. Chemists among the men who survived the attack recognized chlorine quickly enough, however, and knew how easy it was to neutralize. Within a week, the women of London had sewn 300,000 pads of muslin-wrapped cotton for soaking in hyposulfite, the first crude gas masks. Even though the German high command allowed the use of gas at Ypres, it apparently doubted its tactical value. It had massed no reserve troops behind the lines to follow up. Allied divisions quickly closed the gap. Nothing came of the attack except agony. Otto Hahn, a lieutenant in the infantry reserve, helped install the gas cylinders, 5,730 of them containing 168 tons of chlorine, originally at a different place in the line. Shovel crews dug them into the forward walls of the trenches at firestep level and sandbagged them thickly to protect them from shellfire. To work them, you connected lead pipe to their valves, ran the pipe over the parapet into no man's land, waited for a rocket to signal a start, and opened the valves for a predetermined time. Chlorine boils at minus 28.5 degrees Fahrenheit, unpressurized. It boiled out eagerly when released. But the prevailing winds had been wrong where Hahn's team of pioneers first installed the chlorine cylinders. By the time the high command decided to remove them to Ypres along a 4-mile front where the wind blew more favorably, Hahn had been sent off to investigate gas attack conditions in the Champagne. In January, he was ordered to German-occupied Brussels to see Fritz Haber. Haber had just been promoted from reserve sergeant major to captain, an unprecedented leap in rank in the aristocratic German army. He needed the rank, he told Hahn, to accomplish his new work. Haber informed me that his job was to set up a special unit for gas warfare. It seems that Hahn was shocked. Haber offered reasons. They were reasons that would be heard again in time of war. He explained to me that the Western fronts, which were all bogged down, could be got moving again only by means of new weapons. One of the weapons contemplated was poison gas. When I objected that this was a mode of warfare violating the Hague Convention, he said that the French had already started it, though not to much effect, by using rifle ammunition filled with gas. Besides, it was a way of saving countless lives if it meant that the war could be brought to an end sooner. Hahn followed Haber to work on gas warfare. So did the physicist James Franck, head of the physics department at Haber's Institute, who, like Haber and Hahn, would later win the Nobel Prize. So did a crowd of industrial chemists employed by IG Farben, a cartel of 8 chemical companies assembled in wartime by the energetic Karl Duisberg of Bayer. The plant at Leverkusen, with the new lecture hall, turned up hundreds of known toxic substances, many of them dye precursors and intermediates, and sent them off to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physical Chemistry and Electrochemistry for study. Berlin acquired depots for gas storage and a school where Hahn instructed in gas defense. He also directed gas attacks. In Galicia, on the Eastern Front in mid-June 1915, the wind was favorable and we discharged a very poisonous gas, a mixture of chlorine and phosgene, against the Russian enemy lines. Not a single shot was fired. The attack was a complete success. Because of its massive chemical industry, which supplied the world before the war, Germany was far ahead of the Allies in the production of chemicals for gas warfare. Early in the war, the British had even been reduced to buying German dyestuffs, not for gas, for dyeing, through neutral countries. When the Germans discovered the subterfuge, they proposed, with what compounding of cynicism and labored Teutonic humor the record does not reveal, to trade dyestuffs for scarce rubber and cotton. But France and Britain went immediately to work. By the end of the war, at least 200,000 tons of chemical warfare agents had been manufactured and used, half by Germany, half by the several allies together. Abrogating the Hague Convention opened an array of new ecological niches, so to speak, in weaponry. Types of gas and means of delivery then proceeded to diversify like Darwin's finches. Germany introduced phosgene next after chlorine, mixing it with chlorine for cloud gas attacks like Hans because of its slow rate of evaporation. The French retaliated in early 1916 with phosgene artillery shells. Phosgene then became a staple of the war, dispensed from cylinders, artillery shells, trench mortars, canisters fired from mortar-like projectors, and bombs. It smelled like new-mown hay, but it was by far the most toxic gas used, 10 times as toxic as chlorine, fatal in 10 minutes at a concentration of 0.5 milligram per liter of air. At higher concentrations, 1 or 2 breaths killed in a matter of hours. Phosgene, carbonyl chloride, hydrolyzed to hydrochloric acid in contact with water. That was its action in the water-saturated air deep in the delicate bubbled tissue of the human lung. It caused more than 80% of the war's gas fatalities. Chlorpicrin, the British called it vomiting gas, the Germans called it Klop, a vicious compound of picric acid and bleaching powder, came along next. German engineers used it against Russian soldiers in August 1916. Its special virtue was its chemical inertness. It did not react with the several neutralizing chemicals packed in gas mask canisters. Only the modest layer of activated charcoal in the canisters removed it from the air by adsorption. So a high concentration could saturate the charcoal and get through. It worked like tear gas but induced nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea as well. Men raised their masks to vomit. If the Klop had been mixed with phosgene, as it frequently was, they might then be lethally exposed. Chlorpicrin's other advantage was that it was simple and cheap to make. The most horrible gas of the war, the gas that started a previously complacent United States developing a chemical warfare capacity of its own, was dichloroethyl sulfide, known for its horseradish or mustard-like smell as mustard gas. The Germans first used it on the night of July 17, 1917, in an artillery bombardment against the British at Ypres. The attack came as a complete surprise and caused thousands of casualties. Defense, in the form of effective masks and efficient gas discipline, had caught up with offense by the summer of 1917. Germany introduced mustard gas to break the deadlock, just as it had introduced chlorine before. Shells marked with yellow crosses rained down on the men at Ypres. At first they experienced not much more than sneezing, and many put away their masks. Then they began vomiting. Their skin reddened and began to blister. Their eyelids inflamed and swelled shut. They had to be led away blinded to aid stations, more than 14,000 of them over the next 3 weeks. Though the gas smelled like mustard in dense concentrations, in low concentrations, still extremely toxic, it was hardly noticeable. It persisted for days and even weeks in the field. A gas mask alone was no longer sufficient protection. Mustard dissolved rubber and leather. It soaked through multiple layers of cloth. One man might bring enough back to a dugout on the sole of his boot to blind temporarily an entire nest of his mates. Its odor could also be disguised with other gases. The Germans sometimes chose to disguise mustard with xylyl bromide, a tear gas that smells like lilac, and so it came to pass in the wartime spring that men ran in terror from a breeze scented with blossoming lilac shrubs. These are not nearly all the gases and poisons developed in the boisterous, vicious laboratory of the Great War. There were sneezing gases and arsenic powders, and a dozen tear gases and every combination. The French loaded artillery shells with cyanide, to no point except hatred, as it turned out, because the resulting vapors were lighter than air and immediately lofted away. By 1918, a typical artillery barrage locomoting east or west over the front lines counted nearly as many gas shells as high explosive. Germany, always logical at war to the point of inhumanity, blamed the French and courted a succession of increasingly desperate breakthroughs. The chemists, like bargain hunters, imagined they were spending a pittance of tens of thousands of lives to save a purseful more. Britain reacted with moral outrage, but capitulated in the name of parity. It was more than Fritz Haber's wife could bear. Clara Immerwahr had been Haber's childhood sweetheart. She was the first woman to win a doctorate in chemistry from the University of Breslau. After she married Haber and bore him a son, a neglected housewife with a child to raise, she withdrew progressively from science and into depression. Her husband's work with poison gas triggered even more desperate melancholy. She began to regard poison gas not only as a perversion of science, but also as a sign of barbarism, a Haber biographer explains. It brought back the tortures men said they had forgotten long ago. It degraded and corrupted the discipline, that is, chemistry, which had opened new vistas of life. She asked, argued, finally adamantly demanded that her husband abandon gas work. Haber told her what he had told Hahn, adding for good measure, patriot that he was, that a scientist belongs to the world in times of peace, but to his country in times of war. Then he stormed out to supervise a gas attack on the Eastern Front. Dr. Clara Immervar Haber committed suicide the same night. The Allied campaign at Gallipoli began on April 25, 1915. The rough, southward-descending Gallipoli Peninsula looked westward toward the Aegean, eastward across the narrow strait known as the Dardanelles, to the ancients and to Lord Byron, the Hellespont. It faced Turkish Asia. Capture the peninsula, control the Dardanelles, then the Sea of Marmara above, then the narrow Bosporus Strait that divides Europe from Asia, then Constantinople, and you might control the Black Sea into which the Danube drains. A vast flanking movement against the Central Powers. Such were the ambitions of the War Cabinet, chivied by Winston Churchill for the Dardanelles campaign. The Turks, whose land it was, backed by the Germans, opposed the operation with machine guns and howitzers. One Australian, one New Zealand, one French colonial, and two British divisions landed at Gallipoli to establish narrow beachheads. The water of one beachhead bay churned as white at first as a rapid, the Turks pouring down 10,000 rounds a minute from the steep cliffs above. Then it bloomed thick and red with blood. Geography, error, and six Turkish divisions under a skillful German commander forestalled any effective advance. By early May, when a British Gurkha and a French division arrived to replace the Allied depletions, both sides had chiseled trenches in the stony ground. The standoff persisted into summer. Sir Ian Hamilton, the Allied commander, Corfu-born, literary, with a boar-stiffened right arm and the best of intentions, appealed for reinforcements. The War Cabinet had reorganized itself and expelled Churchill. It assented with reluctance to Hamilton's appeal, and shipped out five divisions more. Harry Moseley shipped out among them. He was a signaling officer now, 38th Brigade, 13th Infantry Division, one of Lord Kitchener's new army batches made up of dedicated but inexperienced civilian volunteers. At Gibraltar on June 20th he signaled his mother, "Our destination no longer in doubt." At Alexandria on June 27th he made his will, leaving everything, which was £2,200, to the Royal Society strictly to be applied to the furtherance of experimental research in pathology, physics, physiology, chemistry, or other branches of science, but not in pure mathematics, astronomy, or any branch of science which aims merely at describing, cataloging, or systematizing. Alexandria was full of heat flies, native troops, and Australians, and after a week they sailed on to Cape Helles, on the southern extremity of the Gallipoli Peninsula, a relatively secure bay behind the trench lines. There they could ease into combat in the form of artillery shells lobbed over the Dardanelles to Europe, as it were, from Turkish batteries in Asia. If men were bathing in the bay, a lookout on the heights blew a trumpet blast to announce a round coming in. Centipedes and sand, Harry dispensing chlorodyne to his men to cure them of the grim amoebic dysentery everyone caught from the beaches, Harry in silk pajamas, sharing out the glorious Tiptree blackberry jam his mother sent. "The one real interest in life is the flies," he wrote her. "No mosquitoes, but flies by day and flies by night, flies in the water, flies in the food." Toward the end of July, the divisions crossed to Lemnos, the stage for the reinforcing invasion. That was to divide the peninsula, gain the heights, and outflank the Turkish lines toward Helles. Hamilton secreted 20,000 men by the dark of the moon into the crowded trenches at a beach called Anzac, halfway up the peninsula, and the Turks were none the wiser. The remainder, some 17,000 new army men, came ashore on the night of August 6, 1915, at Sulva Bay north of Anzac, to very little opposition. When the Turks learned of the invasion, they moved new divisions down the peninsula by forced march. The objective of the 38th Brigade, what was left of it toward the end, after days and nights of continuous marching and fighting, was an 850-foot hill, Chanukbayir, inland a mile and a half from Anzac. To the west of Chanuk Bayir and lower down was another hill with a patch of cultivated ground, the farm. Mosley's column, commanded by Brigadier A.H. Baldwin, struggling up an imprisoning defile a yard wide and 600 feet deep, found its way blocked by a descending train of mules loaded with ammunition. That was scabby passage, and the brigadier, in a fury of frustration, led off north toward the farm, over ghastly country in the pitch dark, says the brigade machine gunner, the men falling headlong down holes and climbing up steep and slippery inclines. But they reached the farm. Baldwin's force then held the far-left flank of the line of 5,000 British, Australians, and New Zealanders, precariously dug into the slopes below the heights of Chanuk Bayir, which the Turks still commanded from trenches. The Turkish reinforcements arrived at night and crowded into the Chanuk trenches, 30,000 strong. They launched their assault at dawn on August 10th with the sun breaking blindingly at their backs. John Masefield, the British poet, was there and lived to report. They came on in a monstrous mass, packed shoulder to shoulder, in some places 8 deep, in others 3 or 4 deep. On the left flank, the Turks got fairly in among our men with a weight which bore all before it, and what followed was a long succession of British rallies to a tussle, body to body, with knives and stones and teeth, a fight of wild beasts in the ruined cornfields of the farm. Harry Mosley, in the front line, lost that fight. When he heard of Mosley's death, the American physicist Robert A. Millikan wrote in public eulogy that his loss alone made the war one of the most hideous and most irreparable crimes in history. Hills shelter the town to the north, the chalk cliff west sustains a broad municipal promenade of lawns and flower beds. The harbor, where Allied soldiers embarked in great numbers for France, offers the refuge of a deep-water pier a third of a mile long with berths for 8 steamers. The town remembers William Harvey, the 17th-century physician who discovered the circulation of blood, as its most distinguished native son. At Folkestone, on a sunny, warm Friday afternoon, May 25, 1917, housewives came out in crowds to shop for the Whitsun weekend. A few miles away, at Shorncliffe Camp, Canadian troops mustered on the parade ground. There was bustle and enthusiasm in town and camp alike. It was payday. Without warning, the shops and streets exploded. A line of waiting housewives crumpled outside a greengrocer's. A wine merchant returned to the front of his shop to find his only customer decapitated. Blast felled passers-by in a narrow passage between 2 old buildings. Horses slumped dead between the shafts of carriages. Finely shattered glass suddenly iced a section of street, a conservatory shed its windows, a crater obliterated a tennis court. Fires bloomed from damaged stores. Only after the first explosions did the people of Folkestone notice the sound of engines beating the air. They hardly understood what they heard. They screamed, "Zeps! Zeps!" for until then Zeppelin dirigibles had been the only mechanism of air attack they knew. "I saw 2 aeroplanes," a clergyman remembered who ran outside amid the clamor, "not Zeppelins, emerging from the disk of the sun almost overhead. Then 4 more, or 5, in a line, and others, all light, bright, silver insects hovering against the blue of the sky. There was about 10 in all, and we were charmed with the beauty of the sight." Charmed, because aircraft of any kind were new to the British sky, and these were white and large. The results were less charming. 95 killed, 195 injured. The parade ground at Shorncliffe Camp was damaged, but no one was hurt. Folkestone was the little Guernica of the Great War. German Gotha bombers, oversized biplanes, had attacked England for the first time, bringing with them the burgeoning concept of strategic bombing. The England squadron had been headed for London, but had met a solid wall of clouds inland from Gravesend. 21 aircraft turned south then and searched for alternative targets. Folkestone and its nearby army camp answered the need. A Zeppelin bombed Antwerp early in the war as the Germans pushed through Belgium. Churchill sent Navy fighters to bomb Zeppelin hangars at Dusseldorf. Goethe's bombed Salonika, and a British squadron bombed the fortress town of Maidos in the Dardanelles during the campaign for Gallipoli. But the Goethes that attacked Folkestone in 1917 began the first effective and sustained campaign of strategic civilian bombardment. It fitted Prussian military strategist Karl von Clausewitz's doctrine of total war in much the same way that submarine attack did, carrying fear and horror directly to the enemy to weaken his will to resist. "You must not suppose that we set out to kill women and children," the captured Zeppelin commander told the British authorities, another rationalization that would echo. "We have higher military aims. You would not find one officer in the German army or navy who would go to war to kill women and children. Such things happen accidentally in war." At first, the Kaiser, thinking of royal relatives and historic buildings, kept London off the bombing list. His naval staff pressed him to relent, which he did by stages, first allowing the docks to be bombed from naval airships, then reluctantly enlarging permission westward across the city. But the hydrogen-filled airships of Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin were vulnerable to incendiary bullets. When British pilots learned to fire them, the stage was set for the bombers. They came on in irregular numbers, dependent in those later years of the war not only on the vagaries of weather, but also on the vagaries, enforced by the British blockade, of substandard engine parts and inferior fuel. A squadron flew against London by daylight on June 13th, 19 days after Folkestone, dropped almost 10,000 pounds of bombs and caused the most numerous civilian bombing casualties of the war, 432 injured and 162 killed, including 16 horribly mangled children in the basement of a nursery school. London was nearly defenseless, and at first the military saw no reason to change that naked condition. The War Minister, the Earl of Derby, told the House of Lords that the bombing was without military significance because not a single soldier had been killed. So the Gothas continued their attacks. They crossed the Channel from bases in Belgium 3 times in July, twice in August, and averaged 2 raids a month through the autumn and winter and spring for a total of 27 in all, first by day, and then increasingly, as the British improved their home defenses, by night. They dropped almost 250,000 pounds of bombs, killing 835 people, injuring 1,972 more. Lloyd George, by then Prime Minister, appealed to the brilliant, reliable Smuts to develop an air program, including a system of home defense. Early warning mechanisms were devised, oversized binaural gramophone horns connected by stethoscope to keen blind listeners, sound-focusing cavities carved into sea cliffs that could pick up the wong-wong of Gotha engines 20 miles out to sea. Barrage balloons raised aprons of steel cable that girdled London's airspace. Enormous white arrows mounted on the ground on pivots guided the radioless defenders in their Sopwith Camels and Pups toward the invading German bombers. The completed defense system around London was primitive but effective, and it needed only technological improvements to ready it for the next war. At the same time, the Germans explored strategic offense. They extended the range of their Gothas with extra fuel tanks. When daylight bombing became too risky, they learned to fly and bomb at night, navigating by the stars. They produced a behemoth new four-engine bomber, the Giant, a biplane with a wingspan of 138 feet, unmatched until the advent of the American B-29 Superfortress more than 2 decades later. Its effective range approached 300 miles. A Giant dropped the largest bomb of the war on London on February 16, 1918, a 2,000-pounder that was 13 feet long. It exploded on the grounds of the Royal Hospital in Chelsea. As they came to understand strategic bombing, the Germans turned from high explosives to incendiaries, reasoning presciently that fires might cause more damage by spreading and coalescing than any amount of explosives alone. By 1918, they had developed a 10-pound incendiary bomb of almost pure magnesium, the electron, that burned at between 2,000 and 3,000 degrees and that water could not douse. Only hope of a negotiated peace restrained Germany from attempting major incendiary raids on London in the final months of the war. The Germans bombed to establish a basis for peace by destroying the morale of the English people and paralyzing their will to fight. They succeeded in making the British mad enough to think strategic bombing through. "The day may not be far off," Smuts wrote in his report to Lloyd George, "when aerial operations with their devastation of enemy lands and destruction of industrial and populous centers on a vast scale may become the principal operations of the war, to which the older forms of military and naval operations may become secondary and subordinate." The United States Army was slow to respond to gas warfare because it assumed that masks would adequately protect U.S. troops. The Civilian Department of the Interior, which had experience dealing with poison gases in mines, therefore took the lead in chemical warfare studies. The army quickly changed its mind when the Germans introduced mustard gas in July 1917. Research contracts for poison gas development went out to Cornell, Johns Hopkins, Harvard, MIT, Princeton, Yale, and other universities. With what a British observer could now call the great importance attached in America to this branch of warfare, Army Ordnance began construction in November 1917 of a vast war gas arsenal at Edgewood, Maryland, on waste and marshy land. The plant, which cost $35.5 million, a complex of 15 miles of roads, 36 miles of railroad track, waterworks and power plants, and 550 buildings for the manufacture of chlorine, phosgene, chlorpicrin, sulfur chloride, and mustard gas, was completed in less than a year. 10,000 military and civilian workers staffed it. By the end of the war, it was capable of filling 1.1 million 75-millimeter gas shells a month, as well as several million other sizes and types of shells, grenades, mortar bombs, and projector drums. Had the war lasted longer, the British Observer notes, there can be no doubt that this center of production would have represented one of the most important contributions by America to the World War. Gas, in any case, was far less efficient at maiming and killing men than were artillery and machine gun fire. Of a total of some 21 million battle casualties, gas caused perhaps 5%, about 1 million. It killed at least 30,000 men, but at least 9 million died overall. Gas may have evoked special horror because it was unfamiliar and chemical rather than familiar and mechanical in its effects. The machine gun forced the opposing armies into trenches. Artillery carried the violence over the parapets once they were there. So the general staffs learned to calculate that they would lose 500,000 men in a 6-month offensive, or 300,000 men in 6 months of ordinary trench warfare. The British alone fired off more than 170 million artillery rounds, more than 5 million tons in the course of the war. The shells, if they were not loaded with shrapnel in the first place, were designed to fragment when they exploded on impact. They produced by far the most horrible mutilations and dismemberings of the war, faces torn away, genitals torn away, a flying debris of arms and legs and heads, human flesh so pulped into the earth that the filling of sandbags with that earth was a repulsive punishment. Men cried out against the monstrousness on all sides. The machine gun was less mutilating but far more efficient, the basic slaughtering tool of the war. Concentrated essence of infantry, a military theorist daintily labeled it. Against the criminally stubborn conviction of the professional officer corps that courage, élan, and naked steel must carry the day, the machine gun was the ultimate argument. "I go forward," a British soldier writes of his experience in an attacking line of troops, "up and down across the ground like a huge ruined honeycomb, and my wave melts away, and the second wave comes up and also melts away, and then the third wave merges into the ruins of the first and second, and after a while the fourth blunders into the remnants of the others." He was describing the Battle of the Somme on July 1, 1916, when at least 21,000 men died in the first hour, possibly in the first few minutes, and 60,000 the first day. Americans invented the machine gun. Hiram Stevens Maxim, a Yankee from Maine, Colonel Isaac Lewis, a West Pointer, director of the U.S. Army Coast Artillery School, William J. Browning, a gunmaker and businessman, and their predecessor, Richard Jordan Gatling, who correctly located the machine gun among automated systems. "It bears the same relation to other firearms," Gatling noted, "that McCormick's Reaper does to the sickle, or the sewing machine to the common needle." The military historian John Keegan writes, "For the most important thing about a machine gun is that it is a machine, and one of quite an advanced type, similar in some respects to a high-precision lathe, in others to an automatic press. Like a lathe, it requires to be set up so that it will operate within desired and predetermined limits. This was done on the Maxim gun by adjusting the angle of the barrel relative to its fixed firing platform and tightening or loosening its traversing screw. Then, like an automatic press, it would, when actuated by a simple trigger, begin and continue to perform its function with a minimum of human attention, supplying its own power and only requiring a steady supply of raw material and a little routine maintenance to operate efficiently throughout a working shift." The machine gun mechanized war. artillery and gas, mechanized war. They were the hardware of the war, the tools. But they were only proximately the mechanism of the slaughter. The ultimate mechanism was a method of organization, anachronistically speaking, a software package. The basic lever, the writer Gil Elliott comments, was the conscription law, which made vast numbers of men available for military service. The civil machinery which ensured the carrying out of this law, and the military organization which turned numbers of men into battalions and divisions, were each founded on a bureaucracy. The production of resources, in particular guns and ammunition, was a matter for civil organization. The movement of men and resources to the front, and the trench system of defense were military concerns. Each interlocking system was logical in itself, and each system could be rationalized by those who worked it and moved through it. Thus, Elliott demonstrates, it is reasonable to obey the law, it is good to organize well, it is ingenious to devise guns of high technical capacity, it is sensible to shelter human beings against massive firepower by putting them in protective trenches. What was the purpose of this complex organization? Officially, it was supposed to save civilization, protect the rights of small democracies, demonstrate the superiority of Teutonic culture, beat the dirty Hun, beat the arrogant British, what have you. But the men caught in the middle came to glimpse a darker truth. The war had become undisguisedly mechanical and inhuman, Siegfried Sassoon allows a fictional infantry officer to see. What in earlier days had been drafts of volunteers were now droves of victims. Men on every front independently discovered their victimization. Awareness intensified as the war dragged on. In Russia, it exploded in revolution. In Germany, it motivated desertions and surrenders. Among the French, it led to mutinies in the front lines. Among the British, it fostered malingering. Whatever its ostensible purpose, the end result of the complex organization that was the efficient software of the Great War was the manufacture of corpses. This essentially industrial operation was fantasized by the generals as a strategy of attrition. The British tried to kill Germans, the Germans tried to kill British and French, and so on. A strategy so familiar by now that it almost sounds normal. It was not normal in Europe before 1914, and no one in authority expected it to evolve, despite the pioneering lessons of the American Civil War. Once the trenches were in place, the long grave already dug, John Masefield's bitterly ironic phrase, then the war stalemated and death-making overwhelmed any rational response. The war machine, concludes Elliott, rooted in law, organization, production, movement, science, technical ingenuity, with its product of 6,000 deaths a day over a period of 1,500 days, was the permanent and realistic factor, impervious to fantasy, only slightly altered by human variation. No human institution, Elliott stresses, was sufficiently strong to resist the death machine. A new mechanism, the tank, ended the stalemate. An old mechanism, the blockade, choked off the German supply of food and materiel. The increasing rebelliousness of the foot soldiers threatened the security of the bureaucrats. Or the death machine worked too well as against France and began to run out of raw material. The Yanks came over with their sleeves rolled up, an untrenched continent behind them where the trees were not hung with entrails. The war putrefied to a close. But the death machine had only sampled a vast new source of raw material, the civilians behind the lines. It had not yet evolved equipment efficient to process them, only big guns and clumsy biplane bombers. It had not yet evolved the necessary rationale that old people and women and children are combatants equally with armed and uniformed young men. That is why, despite its sickening squalor and brutality, the Great War looks so innocent to modern eyes.